Hello, welcome to Poet Runner, the podcast where we talk about poetry and running. And today we have Charles Harper Webb, but we won't be talking about his poetry because he wrote a book called Ursa Lake on Red Hen Press, which Richard Modiano already reviewed, and we're going to be talking to him about the process of this book and why he started writing the book instead of poetry. There we go. Richard, do you want to start asking?
Sure, yeah. Well, this is your first novel, correct?
Yeah.
And I know, well, you know, you already have a terrific track record as a poet and as, if not the originator, but certainly the exemplifier of stand-up poetry, which is a kind of poetry that relates to audiences and that goes straight to them without the fog of deciphering what the poet is saying. Which is not to say that it is that the poetry cannot be rich and elusive, which it is. But one of the things that I noticed in this novel, in which, by the way, for listeners, I would classify it as a horror novel. Now, if you guys are uncomfortable with that genre, there are a lot of great books that have been written in that genre, and I think that Ursula Lake stands amongst them, quite frankly. It is incredibly well plotted. The characters live and breathe. They have backstories. They have a psychological depth that makes them come to life, which you often, for regular horror fans are used to sort of one-dimensional characters with limited emotional responses and put through familiar situations where we know what's going to happen, how they're going to react. And sort of the question is, who's going to live, who's going to die? What is the next scene of Jeopardy coming up? Well, your book transcends all that, and at the same time, it seems to me firmly rooted in that genre.
Yeah, I agree. I just set out to write a book that was set in the deep north woods in British Columbia, and to have a book that was really interesting and it kept me excited as I was writing it. And so I didn't set out to write horror. I knew it was going to be a thriller type, and I knew that there would be some violence in it, because that kind of comes out of the setting, really. But now that I look back on it, I can see, well, yeah, it really does hit a lot of those horror buttons. I hope that it transcends the strictly genre stuff, but at least, if nothing else, I wanted it to be an entertaining read.
Yeah, well, I think it does transcend the strictly horror tropes, which is good, which sort of elevates it above the common run of horror novels. And the other thing that I will confess that I am a horror fan. I've read a lot of it. And I have stopped reading certain authors because they are repetitious and, you know, they just don't do it for me. And I know that he is the king of horror, is Stephen King, but there's a certain point where it loses interest. And if you want a little bit more from popular literature, I as a reader, I want a little bit more than going through the motions. And and your prose style is the thing that hooked me. I mean, for any kind of fiction writing, the first thing that grabs me as a reader is the prose style. I mean, is this a prose style that is going to draw me in beyond following the plot and finding out what happens next? And that is totally missing from a lot of popular literature. So I think you've been able to you have a foot in both worlds, so to speak. So we have the kind of prose style that we expect from mainstream thought-out fiction, and at the same time, we still have the excitement and the page-turning enthusiasm of a popular novel. So I think that's that for me, that is what made the book really good.
Well, that makes me really happy to hear you say that. I mean, because that really is what I wanted to do. And you know, you mentioned stand-up poetry. Stand-up poetry is also a form of poetry that tried to have a foot in both worlds. I mean, at least speaking for myself, when I write what I call a stand-up poem, I want it to absolutely work as poetry and to have all of the virtues of poetry, all of the good writing and the imagination and the imagery and all of the stuff that college professors, of which I am one, like to talk about. But I also want it to rock. I want it to make, you know, I want it to attract an audience and to have an audience enjoy it. It's not medicine. It's fun. That's the point. So I tried.
That's
to do
a good
the
way of putting it. It's not medicine. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it is. It is odd because I did not start out to write a horror novel. I started out to write. I mean the beginning, the working title of this thing. I mean obviously I knew this would never be the real title, but it was simply Canadian Adventure. I just wanted to write an adventure story that was set in British Columbia, around fishing and out in the very deep North Woods where there's not much help around. So this is what came out.
Well, the other thing is you vividly evoke that terrain, that Canadian terrain, that North Woods terrain, that sense of isolation, sort of the awe of being surrounded by nature, and the idea that civilized people taken out of their usual environment, urban environment, city environment, have to rely on themselves both physically and psychologically. That was another great thing I liked about the book.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's good. Again, these are all things that I wanted to be in there. I mean, you know, I'm very interested in the human psyche, and I like to explore that. That's an interesting thing for me to do, and it's easier to do it, I think, in a novel than it is in poetry. You can do it in poetry, and I do try, but you can really dig your, you know, you can really dig into it with a novel.
Yeah, so. Maybe you could read a passage that sort of sets the scene for us, for the listeners, to give them an idea of what we've been talking about.
Okay, well, what I'm going to do is just start reading at the beginning.
Okay.
So, yeah, because that way I don't have to explain anything, and you'll see he's moving in. This character is moving into this world where the novel's going to take Okay, part one. Scott Murray was heading north on Highway 97 when he saw ahead and to his right a deer sprawled in a heap beside the road. Ah, man, no animal on earth ever evolved to deal with cars. The sense that he, as human, was to blame made Scott slow down as he passed the deer and so saw its head move. Checking his mirror, no cops, no cars at all, he pulled to the road shoulder and stopped. His watch said 104, but the air felt like morning, misty and cool as he eased out of his blue Datsun pickup, braced himself for what he'd see, then started down the shoulder toward the deer. Across the road, pine, spruce, and fir rose like a green forest wall. A few feet from the gravel shoulder where he walked, a canyon plunged toward a silver creek, wriggling and glittering far below. In the States, there would have been a guardrail. In British Columbia, they would run out of guardrails long before they ran out of risky roads. Reaching the deer, a good-sized whitetail, Scott saw that, yes, it was alive. He also saw there was no hope. The creature's dark, luminous eyes stared straight ahead, its ear cups twisting as if listening for death. The deer's hind quarters were caked in blood. Its back legs were crooked, snapped. Its spine probably was, too, hit most likely by a big rig that just kept blasting on. The decent thing would be to end its misery. But how? His only weapon was a hatchet in his truck. Could he, as an act of mercy, hack this deer to death? He'd read a William Stafford poem where a traveler finds a dead doe on a canyon road, drags it to the shoulder, and feels a fawn moving inside. But the deer in front of Scott was not a doe. Antlers had sprouted, four blunt prongs like velvet-covered coral. As Scott stared at the antlers, he saw that the deer's eyes were fixed on him. Fixed, he would have sworn, in pain and fear, and something else, a gratitude that he was here, a wish not to die alone. Anthropomorphizing, science would say. Still, Scott touched the creature's flank, just barely moving up and down. He felt lightheaded, probably from seeing so much blood as he stroked the quivering flank. I'm here, he told the dying animal. I'm here. The deer gave something like a sigh as Scott kept stroking, staring into those lucent brown eyes. What did they see, he wondered, when they looked at him? He pictured himself standing like a deer in thick woods, smelling the pine, the damp, the tang of leaf decay. The greenery around him swayed in a slight breeze, as if it were breathing. In his mind, he began to run. Still a man, but with the grace and power of a deer, he bounded up high hills and down, following trails that squeezed under gigantic trees and through tangles of briared brush. He ran with what felt like unlimited power, and a sense that the deer had called him here for something special, something grand. Was this some Keatsian reverie? Whatever it was, he kept running, the thrill turning to fear. Something was chasing him, coming up behind. He neared a chasm too wide to jump, and still he ran, ran and ran, then launched himself into the air. At that instant, the deer gave another sigh. Plugged, the light left its eyes. They didn't close or turn away from Scott. They simply ceased to see. And with that ceasing, his reverie or vision or whatever it had been ceased too. He stopped stroking and let his hand rest on the deer's rib cage. No movement up or down, stone still. Good, he told the forest. No more pain. The sight of the deer's antler buds watered his eyes. No telling how big he'd have grown, how many bucks he'd have fought, fawns he'd have sired. The antlers weren't what anyone would call a rat. Still, some driver might decide to take the head, stuff it, and mount it on a wall. That was not going to happen, no damn way. In Stafford's poem, the speaker, knowing he couldn't save the fawn, thought hard for us all, then pushed the dead doe off the cliff. Scott gripped his deer by his forelegs and, straining every muscle he'd developed at the gym, dragged the creature to the edge of the drop-off. It wasn't sheer, but it was steep. Given a shove, the deer might roll all the way down. Dropping to his knees, Scott placed his hands on the still warm belly, choosing spots where the coarse red-brown hair was free from blood. Three hard shoves, and the deer was sliding, then rolling into the canyon. Scott watched it roll faster, then snag on a rock and stop halfway to the creek. Some mountain lion, coyote, or bear might find it there. Vultures and crows would feast for sure. Anything left of the carcass would rot and bit by bit finish its journey to the creek. As for his own journey, two more hours would get him to Winoma, an hour more, and his pilgrimage to Oso Lake would be done. So that's the beginning.
That really draws the reader in for sure.
We
learn a lot about Scott in small details, like the muscles that he developed at the gym, for example. That tells you a little bit about the guy. You know, the observant reader can pick up something from that. Well, I got an idea of who this guy is. He goes to the gym. He has a sense of empathy. And, you know, all in this very brief passage in the beginning, this comes through. So you're already starting to know who Scott is right from the beginning with a little detail here, a little detail there. And that is what and this is throughout the novel, I noticed, by the way. It was so well constructed along those lines. I mean, I don't know if that was worked in consciously or intuitively. I mean, all artists are working on both levels. They're working consciously, and they are working intuitively.
Right.
So,
And that's the answer to the question. Yeah. The process of writing a novel is a lot about kind of discovering who your characters are. I had some idea of who my main characters were, before I really got into the book too much. I knew kind of who they were, but by the time I finished writing it, they were way different from who they began, because they began as kind of ideas, and then if you're lucky, you tap into the humanity of them, and you were, at least I was working. Sometimes it was intuitive, sometimes it was craft, because you see something, you develop it, say you develop an image, and then you realize, oh, that could work again, and so you put it in somewhere else. I'm trying to be true to what a human being would do. At the same time, I also want to be interesting. I want things to happen that are going to be interesting. That's always in the forefront of my mind. You know, what would be something cool and interesting that could happen that would also be believable and would really grow out of the character and the setting and so forth. So that's what I'm trying to do, and it's with a novel. A lot of time it's like you're on a trapeze or something, and you let go of one and you just swing through the air and you hope there's another one there to grab onto, because you don't know what it's going to be. You have to kind of invent the other trapeze as you're flying toward it.
So when you started this novel, your first novel, did you know how it was, what the conclusion, what would be, what, how it would end? I mean,
no.
Who would live, who would die?
No,
you didn't. Okay. That's even better to know. Because in reading it, I did get this sort of, there was a sort of surprise of what's going to happen next. There was a refreshing lack of calculation that you can often spot in popular literature. So you can almost predict what's going to happen to this guy next.
Yeah, you can always figure it out. It's got to, if it's going to fit the form. No, I very much try to create these characters and set them acting and see what happens. I mean, you know, it's strange to talk about it that way, because it sounds kind of mystical, and it really isn't. It's a lot of hard work, but the intuition does come in, and you try out different things, and some possibilities seem resonant and some don't. So, you know, I throw away the ones that don't seem resonant and hope that I get enough that do seem resonant, that the story keeps going. Because if you put interesting characters in difficult situations, something's going to happen. You know, I kind of believe that. I mean, I have written prose before. I've tried. I wrote a young adult novel that didn't get published, but I learned something in doing that. It's really back and forth. Intuition, craft. And I want to be excited with it. If I already know everything that's going to happen when I write it, I don't think I could face writing the book, because it's really a grind in a lot of ways to write a novel and to refine all of that prose and try to make it sing. If you don't have something that's exciting, I wouldn't have the patience. So yeah, I excite myself by letting myself see what happens and surprising myself. Yeah, I think Robert Frost gets credited with saying, "No surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader." I think that's true.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth, because that was what I was going to mention that. But yeah, that is absolutely true. And I did get that feeling throughout the book. Like I said up front, it is a page-turner. You do want to know what happens next. you do want to see how these characters develop, how they cope with the situations that happen to them. I don't want to give away too much about the plot, you know, any spoilers, because I want people to read this book with an open mind, as it were, and I want them to be surprised and thrilled and moved by what happens. But in spite of this wonderful opening, this sort of evocation of nature, the empathy that the protagonist shows toward the dying animal, the vivid scene that comes before us that is, in a way, both poignant and soothing. There is some friction in this book too. There are some scary parts, let's put it that way. And maybe you could give us a sample of one of those.
Oh, okay, sure. Hold on a sec. I've got one right here. Let me see. Hold on. I know I have it. Let me find it. Hold on, I wrote it down. Okay, 51 to 50. All right, yeah, here we go. I have to set the scene a little bit here.
Go ahead.
Scott and his friend Errol are fishing. They're on this on a lake, Oso Lake, up there in the north, and they've just heard a pretty scary story that the campsite where they were at was the scene of a murder in the fall, a very grisly one, the fall before. They're in early spring when the novel starts, and so they're kind of spooked. And as they're going along, suddenly they hear a very loud noise that scares them, and they kind of jump down in the boat. They think it might be a shot. It turns out it isn't. But then they think it's a giant fish, and so Scott casts his fly into what he hopes is a deep hole. And then he thinks he gets a great strike. But if any of you guys fished, you know about this. The great strike turns out to be a snag, and so they have to go in and deal with that and untangle the fly, which is stuck. So that's where it starts. The deep hole, when they reached it, went down barely 2 feet. The bottom was a snarl of roots that stretched like shaggy tentacles out from the trees on shore. As Scott's fingers followed his leader to where it disappeared in green-black moss, the spinning in his head increased. He felt lightheaded the way he had with the dying deer. Shadows danced on the water. Weird shapes flickered out and in. A tightness clamped down on his chest. Is this a heart attack, he wondered, fighting panic? A stroke? Don't be a wuss, he thought. You just need a nap. The moss looked like it could hide some knife-toothed Northwoods eel. Poking through slime, he felt his fly and tried to twist it free. As if he'd turned a switch, the water in the hole began to glow. A woman's corpse lay tangled in the moss and roots. Her head was gone. Ribbons of gray skin wavered in an underwater breeze. The rotting tube of her neck rose like a trout, gaped, and slurped his hand inside. He tried to yank it back. His hand went numb, then his arm, then all of him. He felt like a convict immobilized by one drug while another sank its teeth into his heart. The monster's throat felt like cold mud. Something rough as a cat's tongue scraped his skin. His hand burned as if stomach acid were digesting his flesh. Some force was trying to pull him out of the boat. It could not be happening, and yet it was. Then the neck tube let go. Scott's hand shot from the water, gripping his fly. Slimy but unharmed. He looked around as if wakened from deep sleep. Jesus! You called? Errol said, just as another whap rang out. 30 yards off, a geyser dropped back in the lake. Close by, a brown head dragged a V-shaped wake. Beaver, Scott said. His head was clear, the water monster gone. Was it a vision or a waking dream? Give me beaver or give me death, Pharaoh proclaimed, grabbed the oars and went splashing and thrashing across the pads.
Yeah, that was a tour de force. I mean, it was so vivid. You could see every action. And I like the way you brought in the textures. I mean, you could feel the guy's hand in there. I mean, it was... Yeah. I'm glad that you picked that part, because I think that is really exemplary of all of the scenes of friction in the novel. They have this they're very gripping and they're frightening. And it's a relief that he gets away. But at the same time, you want to know what really happened. I mean, this sort of gives a momentum to the story, because the scenes like this make you, what is the explanation? What is behind this?
I didn't mention this, but the story about the murder was that at this place where they're camping, just a little small place in the woods where there's one little campfire kind of circle, that a woman's head was found there, and that was all that was found, just the head. And it was only found, you know, it was right before the snow came, and the place had been deserted for months. And so it was very, anyway, that relates to the fact that the monster there didn't have a head, as if you need more stuff. But I do try to tie things together like that. It's not just like a random creepy scene. Yeah.
No.
I mean, just, you've read it all. You know that it wasn't, but I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. Well, for our listeners, yeah, the book is beautifully constructed, and each piece fits together. It will be like, when you get to the end, it will be like seeing a completed jigsaw puzzle, and you will be surprised. So...
Richard, 3 minute warning.
Okay. Well, I guess what is coming up for you, Charles?
Yep.
Well, I'm working on several things at once. I always do. I'm working on poetry. I've got another manuscript of poetry that I'm putting together. I've got a manuscript of prose poems I'm putting together, and I'm working on another novel. In fact, I'm very close to finishing, and that one also, I just decided to go for it. That one's like horror/supernatural, but again, not a run-of-the-mill one. One that I think readers will find entertaining and surprising and lyrical and not just creepy, but plenty creepy.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mentioned this earlier, there was the only other writer I can think of that has this quality that I saw in Ursula Lake was the Irish writer Dorothy McArdle, who wrote two novels. One was called The Unseen and the other was The Uninvited. And The Uninvited was made into a 1940s movie, but the beauty and the horror, I mean, when I say beauty, I mean the beauty of the prose and the rich descriptiveness of it is unmatched in a way, except that's why I thought of Dorothy McArdle, because she does bring that kind of thing in, and that's pretty rare. So
yeah, well, it's great to have a haunting and beautiful background for haunting and scary things to go on. So yeah, the one that I'm working on now has also got a very haunting background in woods. It's a different woods, but it's I feel very at home and very I love the woods. I love lakes and rivers and woods
that,
and
that definitely comes through. That definitely comes through. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Charles, and I look forward to this next novel.
Yeah, well, good. I look forward to it, too. I'm trying to figure out, okay, you know, there's still a few surprises left for me, but it's getting down there now. So, yeah, I really appreciate your reading of the book and the way I think you got right to the heart of it. So when I first heard it on, you know, Raphael sent me the URL or whatever, I heard it, and I thought, shit, man, he got it. That's it. That's
thank
it.
You. So we've been talking to Charles Harper Webb, pardon me, about his book Ursula Lake, which is a fine supernatural horror novel, beautifully written, with depth, subtly and finesse. You know, what more could you ask for in a novel? And go out and get it. Either order it directly from the publisher, get it from your independent bookstore, or as a last resort, you can order it from Amazon. But I do recommend the first two in preference to going to Amazon.
All right. Well, hey, thank you very much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming.
All right. So.
Now we move on to, and I'm hoping not to mess up her name, Lynette, Jeanette?
Yeah. Lynette.
Hello?
Yeah. Hello?
Hello, did I get your last name right, or did I? Because I've practiced
Lynette
for about
Pettinucci.
Pettinucci, that's what I was going to say, then I messed it up, man. And I spent a half hour running saying that name over and over, thinking I was going to get it right.
It is a tricky one.
Yeah, it is. Let's start off. How long have you been running? And when did you start running?
I started running in about 2011. So just over 10 years, I guess, because it is 2022. I ran a little bit in college, not very well. I definitely didn't have the appropriate clothing. I think I was just doing it for some exercise. But once I graduated college, I actually was biking, trying to lose that college weight, and I got hit by a car. So that whole first summer, I was in a boot. I couldn't really do much of anything. So once I got the boot off and I was cleared to resume physical activity, I was still, you know, coming home from college, you're a little broke, you didn't have any money. And I was really grateful that nothing really bad happened from that accident. I was like, well, I've got both of my legs. I guess I could try running. So I was running around my neighborhood. I was not running as far or as fast as I thought I really was. And I signed up for a turkey trot. It was just a 5K. And I did the turkey trot, and I kind of got the running bug from there. And I haven't stopped since.
Hmm. Which turkey trot? Because you're located in New York?
I'm located in New York. This was the Smiles Change Live turkey trot on Long Island.
Yeah, because we have a turkey trot out here, and I didn't want to get it confused with our turkey trot, you know. Because, turkey trots are fun.
It was a lot of fun. I'm glad that I chose it as my first foray into running races. And the organization that put it on, it was a very hometown fun experience. So I try and run a lot of races. They kind of emulate that. I like stuff with crowds, friendly, things of that nature.
Now I got a question. I mean, when I run to just run, I'm not worried about time, and I seem to run faster when I do a marathon or I do a 5K. When you train, are you worried about time? Are you worried about how fast you're running, or do you just run?
When I'm actually training for a race, I do try and pay attention to what my pace is and stick to the ranges that my coach gives me. But right now, I'm kind of just fun running until half marathon training starts. So this morning when I went for a run, I was actually running a little bit faster than I thought I was. But I wasn't checking my watch. I was just out there running to run.
Yeah, I tend to go for distance, and I don't worry about the speed, even though my watch obnoxiously tells me every mile how fast I'm running. You know, I don't want to know. It's just, it'll tell me, and it's like,
of course.
No matter what, even if I take it off the Bluetooth, it's going to tell me how fast I'm running.
Yeah,
no, I mean,
when I'm running distance, I don't look at it as much. I kind of care, like if I'm marathon training or I'm doing my Friday morning long run, I care a little bit less
mm-hmm.
about pace than just making sure those miles are in, they're consistent,
mm-hmm.
And I get up to the mileage. But during the week, especially when I'm just fun running, I do look at the watch.
I mean, today, I know, I mean, I feel bad when I run 10 miles in over 2 hours, but at the same time, I still ran 10 miles. But
exactly.
I tend to try to get it, under 2 hours. But sometimes, guys, sometimes I forget that I'm running uphill, and that does factor in. You know, you do slow down when you do a lot of uphills.
Yes. It's interesting to watch the metrics on that, too, because sometimes I will go back and look like, wow, that was like a much slower mile than I thought I was running. And then I remember where I was when that mile was happening. I'm like, oh, you were going up a giant hill.
Yeah. But we forget that when we're training. We just need to look at our time thinking it was bad. But then we do factor in the hill that we're running. So sometimes I found a hill that's like 2 miles straight up. And then I forget that's going to knock off a lot of time.
Yeah.
I do the uphills just because every race is different, and some races got hills that you're not ready for. Yeah.
I agree. I'm running a race up in the Adirondacks in September. So we've added some hill training, extra hill training for the summer, just in case it's a bit hillier than we anticipated.
Well, I mean, I noticed when I was running a half marathon, the Griffith Park half marathon, a lot of people who weren't ready for the hills, they were walking up the hills, while the people who were ready were just running up the hills. And you could tell the ones, people who
trained
the hills.
Yeah, I feel like that happens in New York, too, when you get up on the Queensboro.
Yeah, because they forgot that, you know, there's going to be uphills, so you should train with hills. And I run uphill at least. Today I did stairs, so I found some stairs, so I did stairs like 3 or 4 times just, you know, to do them. You know, because it's good training if you do a lot of uphills, but a lot of people don't like the uphills, but I'd rather run uphill than downhill. I don't like downhill. I hate downhill.
I don't particularly enjoy the uphill, but I do know that it makes me stronger and
mm-hmm.
I'm better for it, so I do it. Being in New York City, I'm kind of lucky because they are just automatically built into my training route.
Oh, there you go.
So I don't have to go very far to find them.
What's your favorite race so far? I mean, and how many marathons and how many 10Ks have you run?
I've run 4 marathons. I've run New York and Chicago twice each. I've run about 20 half marathons. And then when I started running, I did more 5Ks and 10Ks, but I think half marathon is my favorite distance.
Yeah, I actually enjoy half marathons, but I like accomplishing the marathon just because it's like when I first start the marathon, I don't think I'm going to – I mean, I never think I'm going to finish. I mean, I just go in there thinking, oh, man, it's going to suck. And then 5 miles into it, okay, I can do it. But I always wake up early in the morning. Do I really want to do this?
Yeah, I enjoy running Chicago because you can stay at a hotel right near the start. You can walk to the start.
Nice.
You don't have to get there 4 hours before your start time. Whereas New York, I tend to start traveling at 6 a.m. even if I don't start until 10:40.
Yeah, no, most of our things start here at 6 in the morning. The Orange County Marathon actually started at 5:30 in the morning, so it's like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of traveling, you know. And when I still haven't figured out how I'm going to get to the Valley Crest Half Marathon because it's about 30 miles from where I live. And do I really want to pay that much for Lyft? I mean, I'll pay for it because the race is already taken care of. But you know, I want to do the race, but at the same time, I'm probably paying more for the Lyft than I actually paid for the race.
Yeah, sometimes it's more challenging to get to the races than it is to actually run them.
I actually got sponsors, and all these people sponsored me, and now I got 6 more marathons to finish for this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I am running 2 more halves this year.
Hmm. Which ones?
The Adirondack half in September, and then I'm running the Philly half in November.
Oh. Nice. I think my friend Benny ran something in New Jersey a couple weeks ago. I know he did some half marathon. I think it was in Brooklyn or something.
Yes, there was a rather large one a few weeks ago in Jersey.
Yeah, I think that's the one he did because he was training for it. Because ever since I started running, I've actually now I have running friends, people that I, you know, and through doing the show now, I've come to know more runners. Next week, I actually have a guy who's actually ran 158 marathons.
Oh, wow.
That's
I'm way behind that number.
So am I. I'm at 9. So I'm a little...
I'm still behind that.
Yeah, but you're probably younger than me, too. So, you know, you got time. You know, and your start. No, the younger you... I mean, I started being serious late. You know, and if I would have started early, I don't know. It's just I'm comfortable with it now, and I enjoy it because I'm healthy. But I know you start younger, you probably get to, you know, 50 or so marathons quicker than somebody who started late. You know, if that's what you're
planning
on. Yeah,
first in 2016. New York was my first.
Wow. You didn't have to qualify?
I did because I live in New York. I did the 9+1.
Okay.
Through New York Roadrunners. So I did the 9 qualifying races plus the 1 volunteer.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, New York and Boston are 2 that I want to run eventually.
Eventually,
I'd
love
San Francisco.
To run Boston. I want to qualify for it.
Well, yeah, same here. But right now my time's kind of short because right now I'm running about 4 hours and 9 minutes for a marathon. And I know it's something like 3:40, so I got to shave more time off.
Yeah. My qualifying time is pretty fast. I'm going to wait until I get a little bit older for that one.
You know, you might hit it sooner without trying, you know, it might just come. You know, I started doing speed runs where I actually got 5 miles in like 38 minutes. But I haven't done that in about a year.
I run with the Hellgate Roadrunners in Queens. We have speed workouts on the track on Wednesdays. So that's always been helpful.
So how often do you run during the week?
I run about 4 days per week, and I supplement with Pilates and yoga.
Mm-hmm.
During the summer, I do a lot of hiking and biking. So sometimes I'll trade a weekend recovery run for a 29-mile bike ride or a 6-mile hike. And in the winter, I snowboard.
Oh, nice.
So I try and get a lot of my runs done during the week. And I do my long run on Fridays.
What do you consider a long run? Everybody's different.
Anything 8 or above is what's on my calendar for a long run usually. So for this half marathon training cycle, I'm training up to 15. For marathons, I train up to 22.
22 miles?
Yeah. I feel more comfortable there because I know, especially in Chicago, I know where the 22-mile marker is, and I know after that that there's only 4 more miles. It's less than an hour, and I know where those 4 miles go. So I like being able to say, all right, I've run 22 in training. There's less than an hour left. You got this. Versus knowing that I have that 10K and it's about an hour. So for me, I run up to 22 because it's psychological.
No, I get that. I try to run. I lost my normal for a little bit. So I've been running 5 miles for like 5 weeks. Now I'm back to 10 to 15 miles a day. But it took me a while to get back here. I think I had a runner's funk or something, or some kind of mental block, but now I feel better because I'm running, you know, longer miles. Because 5 miles is easy once you've done it long enough.
Yeah.
You know.
During the winter I get into a little bit of a funk because I'm not big on running in the cold. It's dark in the morning. I just don't find it as enjoyable. But May through September, I think that's my favorite time to be running. I started like 5:30 a.m. I have time to get everything done during the day. I feel accomplished. I feel good. And it's light out at that time. It's warm.
Yeah. No, the funny thing about people in L.A., I mean, I've ran in what we call rain, and it's like, this isn't rain, it's sprinkling. And I'm not getting soaked. And then people complain about the cold weather, but I know in New York it's freezing compared to here. So I've ran when it's been kind of cold here. And it's a totally different headspace that you have to be for, I think, in New York, because it gets a lot freaking colder. So to be able to run in that cold, I respect people who can run in that cold, but I don't know if I could do it because it's a different, you know, something you got to deal with more. You got to deal with your shoes and your feet being wet and a bunch of other factors. You know, there's snow. You know, there's a bunch of things you got
to deal with.
Yeah,
it definitely takes me longer to get out the door in the winter. And you have to bundle up more. I really just like putting on a pair of shorts, a shirt, and being able to leave instead of layering everything on.
Yep. No, the funny thing here in L.A., which is, to me, L.A. is funny because they say, you know, storm watch. And then, you know, I get my rain gear on and I get ready to run, and then I run the whole thing in my rain gear and not a drop of rain. So I'm kind of like,
I've done that before.
Why did I?
It's very, embarrassing because people are just staring at me. And I'm like, the weather said it was going to downpour.
Well, yeah, and I'm like, I actually ran one time in a t-shirt. We actually had a downpour for about 5 more miles because I wanted to finish my 10. The funny thing is I was okay running in the rain, but then when I went to catch the bus and it was pouring, I was more upset that it was pouring when I was walking.
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually. There's nothing worse than, you know, running in the rain and you're like, oh, shit, I'm a half a mile from home. I now need to walk home in this.
Yeah, no, the thing is, and also I don't like walking in the heat, but I don't mind running in the heat. So, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, the way that works.
Yeah, there's no perfect weather for us, so I prefer the heat over anything.
I like the heat, and people go, you like running in 100-degree weather? I go, well, you know, sooner or later I'm going to want to run, like, a really hot race for 26 miles, so it's better I get used to it now than later. You know, just so I know I'm not going to pass out. You know, nice to be strong enough to keep running.
Yeah.
Oh, what do you enjoy about running? I know I enjoy the high. I just enjoy, like, how high I feel running.
I feel like it makes me feel emotionally good and physically good. I feel like I can get lost in it. Sometimes if I'm in a bad mood, I'll go out for a run, but the run will start pretty crappy because I'm already in a bad mood. But by the time it keeps going, I'm just like, oh, I feel really good right now. I feel better. And I get out of my own head. I do run with music often when I'm training. I've never run any of my marathons with music, but I do train with music. And sometimes I just put on a good playlist and, like, just tune everything out. I own a PR firm in New York City, so it can be really stressful. So it's really nice to be able, you know, if just things are bad during the day, I can go out at 1 p.m. Like, all right, I need to reset this whole day, and I'll go for a run.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way when I'm feeling. I mean, I've been facing a screwed-up kind of eviction thing, so that's what put me in the funk. So I'd always run my 5 miles, but I'd run by the house to make sure I wasn't locked out. But that's where it was for a while. And then things are basically resolved now, so that's why I've gone back up to 10 to 15 miles because I'm no longer in limbo. But that was stressing me out. But at the same time, getting the 5 miles still helped, but I still felt like I was shorting myself not doing 10 to 15. You know, because my normal is running distance for me right now, and it makes me feel good. But when I couldn't, it made me feel bad, like I was letting myself down. It's kind of funny. We are our own worst judges, you know.
We really are.
You know, people can sit there and judge you, but no one's going to judge you as badly as you judge yourself, you know.
No, and it's really – funny because you kind of see that. I have a lot of friends. I have friends who run my running team, but then I have friends who don't run, and they'll come out and celebrate with me after races, and they're just like in awe. They're like, oh, my God, you just ran a marathon, and now you're sitting here drinking beer with us. And I'm like, yeah, but these splits, they were so bad. This was horrible. I can't believe I made that mistake. I didn't hydrate right. They don't care. They're like, we don't see any of that. We just think it's so cool that you just did that.
Well, some of my runner friends and my non-runner friends think I'm nuts because I don't drink water when I do marathons.
Do you drink anything?
Nope.
Yeah,
I just drink a lot of water afterwards.
I don't really drink.
I think I built up a tolerance or something, you know, because at one time, just for sheer hell of it, I accidentally ran 26 miles. I went up to the Hollywood sign and ended up in Burbank. I ended up going by Bob's Big Boy, then back to the gym. And then when I finished, I realized I ran 26 miles. I wasn't planning on running 26 miles. I just
can't say that I've accidentally run a marathon.
I've done some stupid accidental things. I actually ran onto the freeway by mistake. And it took me a half mile to realize, I'm on the freeway. This is bad. Because I started seeing the cars getting near. They're getting really close. It's like, I had to hop the fence, get back on the right side of the road. And it's just like, but the thing that really screwed me up was nobody was honking at me. You'd think somebody would honk, get the hell off the freeway, but no.
Yeah.
Nobody was concerned enough to tell me I'm on the freeway. No, they just figure I'm a nut who doesn't know better, probably. This is Hollywood, you know, because I've lived here all my life, but I still do not like the strangeness that happens in my city because it's just it's a little bit much sometimes. You know, I mean, Hollywood gets a bad rap, and sometimes it deserves it. You know, it's like the L.A. Marathon. We had the L.A. Marathon, and we had Oscar statues, and people who were running the marathon were stopping to take a picture by the Oscar sign. That made no sense to me. Who stops while they're running a marathon?
I mean, I guess if you're running a bigger race, a lot of people, when they're running New York, they'll stop and take pictures on the Verrazano or throughout the city.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, I don't like stopping. I don't like stopping when I run. You know, I don't like not. I don't because I'm always afraid of getting side aches if I stop. You know, so I tend to try to keep jog in place when I'm at a red light. I mean, that's just me. I know a lot of people stop at lights, but I don't like stopping the motion. I mean, how do you feel about it?
I stop at lights, especially intersections where I have to stop. Some of them I'll run through depending on what traffic looks like or if it's like in the middle of the neighborhood. But I'll stop there. And I've stopped during my first New York. I stopped to say hi to everyone who was cheering for me. Just because it was my first marathon. It was my first New York. It was New York. But after that, I haven't stopped throughout.
So what are your long-term goals for running? Do you want to do an ultra or are you just marathons or just half marathons?
I think marathon is the longest distance for me. I'm comfortable with it. I like it. I think I still have a lot of work to do on that specific distance, so I don't want to add something longer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a trail runner, so none of that really interests me. I'm trying
trails
to break a half marathon PR. Yeah, I'm not a trail runner.
But they're good.
I'm a hiker, though. I enjoy hiking. I don't enjoy running.
All right. You know what? Since you're a hiker, that means at least you see nature. But the thing I like about trail runs is you're running in nature and there's no distraction. There's no cars. There's no people. I like it. I mean, it to each his own, but I like trails just because they feel they're more calming to me than the city. You know?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely
calming.
That's why I like hiking. I don't think I would enjoy trail running because I would just stop to look at everything just because I am a hiker and that's in my nature. But I am looking to break my half marathon PR in the next 2 years.
Well, what's your PR right now?
So it's from 2014, and it was a 201.06.
That's not bad, you know.
No, but then I lost some. I started focusing on marathons after that. I had some injuries. I stopped running for a little bit. So I have to build all of that back.
No, I understand that. I had a hernia operation 3 weeks before the Long Beach Marathon. I still ran it.
You still ran?
But it was painful. I paid for it. You know, it's like, this is so stupid
yeah.
Way my head works. I paid for it. Now I got to run it. Or if someone sponsored me, well, I really got to run it because I don't want to pay them back. You know?
It's true. Races are a lot of money.
Nope. That's why, you know, the funny thing, I'm blessed because most of my friends are poets like me. And they're sponsoring me by, they either pay for the run, and then sometimes they pay for a t-shirt with their poem and the book cover on the front, poem on the back, and boom, I got a sponsor.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, no, I'm happy to say that my friends, you know, care and support what I'm doing, so it's nice. Well, they'd rather have me running than drinking, because 28 years ago, they did not like me drinking, so they're actually happy that I'm healthy.
That is fair. That's really great.
Oh, no. I mean, I've always loved running, but I never took it as serious as I'm taking it now. I mean, I need to run every day to feel good. It's the beginning of the day, and it releases stress, and then the rest of the day is easy. You know, got my run.
I agree. I feel really accomplished when I run in the morning. And
well,
I like that it leaves
like,
my
know,
evenings open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's nice because you're doing something nobody else really. I mean, there's a good portion of people that are runners, but a lot of people do not do what we do. You know, they don't wake up in the morning, they don't run, they don't go to the gym, they don't have a set routine. You know, I mean, not saying that their lives are less than ours, but in the morning we're accomplishing something that, you know, it takes a lot of energy just to get the hell out of bed. And that early in the morning, sometimes the bed is like, you don't want to leave. And I'm like, oh, I got to leave. But the bed's like, oh, no, you want to stay. You know, I mean, it's pretty easy to just, like, you know, hit the snooze button and keep on sleeping. You know, but I try not to.
I snooze for about 20 minutes.
There you go. I've done that. So what do you do for nutrition and supplements? Do you take supplements or do you just eat well?
I try to get all of my nutrients from food. I do have a nutrition certification and I teach Pilates, so I kind of try and practice
mm-hmm.
what I share with those types of clients. When I'm
mm-hmm.
running, I started using Science and Sport, those gels, and I really
mm-hmm.
like them.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I like Liquid IV. But otherwise, I take some vitamins. So I take some vitamins that have B complex in them. I take iron, and I take a probiotic. Those are kind of my core supplements that I would take in the morning.
I've been taking something from 6 a.m. called Bolt. It works pretty good. It gets me going. I think it gives me extra energy, but I'm not sure. But then the energy, I mean, it might be in my head. It might just be a placebo. I don't know, but I mean, it feels good. I mean. And then I take CMA for muscle recovery because I also work out with weights, and I take a bunch of stuff just mm-hmm. to, you know, keep myself in shape. It just becomes routine after a while. You know, and being healthy is not cheap.
Yeah, I try not to take too much stuff. I try and get what I can get from food, but sometimes
mm-hmm.
I just don't eat. Like, for iron, I don't not like red meat, and I don't not eat red meat, but I just don't eat it very often. Just because.
My diet sucks because I work at a restaurant, so every night it's a different meal. You know, that's not exactly healthy, and I'm on a budget, so I've actually eaten peanut butter sandwiches every day for the last 2 years. It's got protein. That's the way I look at it.
I was just about to say it's protein.
No, but the funny thing is I have two boiled eggs in the morning every morning for breakfast, and then the peanut butter sandwiches, and then the dinner. And somehow, you know, with the protein drink that I have, it balances out, you know, where I Mm-hmm. I'm still healthy. I'm not run down.
I'm a big fan of eggs. I eat eggs for breakfast every morning.
Yeah, I actually put them in my protein drink, too. So I have a lot of egg stuff in me.
Mm-hmm.
What was your biggest, your most favorite race? I mean, which one do you enjoy the most and fondest memory of race?
For a marathon, it's always going to be New York. That will never change my mind. Living in New York, running New York, that's my favorite race ever. My first half marathon was pretty fun. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was in D.C., the Nike Women's Half in D.C. in 2013. And I really liked that one because, one, it was my first half, but I'd also never been to D.C., so I got a nice little tour of the city.
I got two favorite half marathons, the Great Race in Griffith Park, and I like the San Francisco Marathon. I really, at this point, don't like the L.A. Marathon. I enjoyed the Orange County, and the rest of the marathons are just, they're not great, but the ones I do love, I remember, but I'll run a marathon, but I know I didn't like it sometimes, you know? Because the race,
that's how
the
feel
course
about the Brooklyn Half Marathon.
There you go. That's how I feel about the Rose Bowl Half Marathon. Is like, okay, I ran it, but it wasn't that great.
Yeah, I've run Brooklyn twice, and I don't know why I signed up the second time because I hated it the first time, and now I will not waste my money on it. I did have someone reach my friends reach out to me this year, like, oh, are you going to sign up? And I was like, no, I can't do it again. I hated it. I'm not going to like it this time. Yeah. It's more expensive.
That sucks because, I understand that, but I'm still doing the L.A. Marathon just because it's the L.A. Marathon, but I hate the course. You know,
I want to I want to do it, but I just physically, I don't think I would ever make myself do it again.
Well, you know, I'm not doing Surf City again because I didn't like it. And I'm looking forward to the Big Bear Marathon because it's got trails. I know you don't like those, but I'm going there for that. I got a baby ultra, and everybody goes, stop calling it a baby ultra. It's an ultra. I go, it's only 31 miles. It's not a real ultra. A no real ultra to me is 50 miles and 100 more, 100 miles. It's 31 miles. It goes, anything past 27, it's an ultra. I go, yeah, but it's still kind of like a baby. You know,
it's still more than I would ever run.
Oh, no. I like how people put it to me when I've been talking about it. It's like, it's just an extra 5 miles. They're probably going to kill you, though. Those extra 5 miles are probably going to kill you, but you're probably going to do it. You know? But you also have to train differently. I mean, for ultras, you got to train differently. You got to eat while you're running. I don't know how to put my head around that. Somebody I talked to
I've munched on pretzels before.
Yeah, but pretzels are, I think pretzels are like a common thing for marathons and a bunch of other place runs. So I've had I like pretzels after I run. I didn't know why, but they just feel good after you. Yeah.
They really do. There's no nutritional value to them, but they are good.
Not really.
Things that crunch. I think that's like the one issue with my diet is I like chips. So I really like things that crunch.
There you go. Well, what shoe do you run in? I didn't ask that. What's your favorite shoe?
I run in Asics. So right now I have Nimbuses. So I used to run in Kayanos, and I think they switched the shoe. They upgraded it, quote unquote, their version of upgrading it. So I didn't like the new Kayanos. So I have Nimbuses that I train in, and I do have the Metaspeed. I think I have Edge for racing.
Oh.
So I have their super shoe.
I got 16 pairs of running shoes right now. I only use 3 pairs. How many?
I have about 3 that I train in, and then I have the 1 racing shoe.
Yeah, I don't know how I got 16. I just started buying. I mean, there's this online thing called Roadrunner, Road Runners, and they always get my shoe size right. And I'm on their VIP thing, so I could send it back in 90 days. So it's like, okay, I'll order some shoes. Do I need them?
I think I do. I don't know. I probably don't, but I like having them. You know, because certain I got shoes for trails, I got shoes for speed, and I got shoes for marathons and distance. And they don't
wear they're all necessary. I collect them, and I don't get rid of them until I really have to.
Actually, my old shoes I end up using to work because tennis shoes to be more comfortable than work shoes. You know, when they're all you know, I won't get rid of them either.
What?
Once
they're done being running shoes, I'll use them to, like, walk around in.
Yep. So what's your big goal for this, for the rest of this year and the next year?
So this year, I'm going to focus on half marathons. So my training starts mid-June, I believe, and we're going to train through summer, test out what the training looks like for September, adjust, and then see how close I can get to my old PR in Philly, and then use that to create the training for next year. I do want to run a marathon next year. The reason I'm running the Philly half is to see if I might want to do the full if I don't get into New York again.
Yeah.
But I do want a faster half time and a faster marathon time. So those are my two goals.
So
to really just get a little bit stronger.
I don't know if this will work for you, but it's been working for me. I actually didn't think it was a good thing, but I just started using weights on my legs, squats and leg press. It actually helps the running, I've noticed. I mean, I wouldn't advise working your legs out a week before a marathon or before a race. I just don't touch that before the race, but it does build your strength in your legs when you're running.
Yeah, I do a lot of Pilates and yoga. Those are my two strength activities. And I do try, I know that I teach Pilates, but I try and take other people's classes. So I have someone giving me corrections and creating a routine for me.
Okay. Well, everybody's got their routine that works for them, you know?
Yeah.
A while to figure out my routine, you know, and what works for me. Everybody tells me I should run first and then go to the gym, but I go to the gym, then I run. And everybody says I'm doing it backwards.
That I have no knowledge on the appropriate order for that. I'm not a running coach, nor am I a personal trainer. So I don't actually know what the correct thing there is.
Well, everybody tells me I'm not doing it right, but I'm just like, it works for me. You know.
I mean, if it works for you, then I wouldn't switch it up, right?
Well, yeah, no, you gotta, I mean, I'm pretty sure your routine is perfect for you and you enjoy it, so it works, and then, you know, you're training the way you know how your body likes it, and then that's what works. You know, so sometimes it's bad to mess with what's not broken, you know, because... You know, it's like when you're at the gym and you try to do a weight that's too heavy because everybody else is stronger than you, and it's like, what happened to him? Oh, he dropped the weight in his face. Good, that weight's too heavy. No, I'm definitely the one.
I never try and go up with the weights. If I'm, like, in a class or something, I'm like, I'm just going to use these really light ones. And the teacher's like, I think you should use the stronger ones, the heavier ones. And I'm like, no, I'm good with these. These feel great.
No, the funny thing about weights that I found out is it doesn't have to be heavy weight. It's about reps. The more repetition, the more tone you get. So, you know, but, I mean, if you're a muscle head and you want to find out how strong you are, then you do heavy weights. You know, not everybody, you know, cares about tone. You care more about strength. Well, like we said, to each their own. So when's your next race? When's it coming up?
September.
September. Great. Well, it's been great having you on. I've enjoyed the talk, and I just enjoy talking to runners because you find out different ways that they think about running and the way you think about running, you know? Yeah,
I
definitely
agree.
Learn things from you. You know, and your attitude, it's different. You seem really happy and positive in the running, but I've talked to some runners that are really intense, you know? It's like, okay. But, you know,
I mean, it's something that I enjoy. I might not be great at it, but I do enjoy it, and I enjoy it for a variety of reasons. And if it's not making me happy, then I adjust something. So if I'm going through a rough patch, then I'll switch to spin class for a second to take a break and reset that. Because then once I get back into it, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is why I like running.
Well, actually, I've had a writer's block with my poetry. So lately I've been writing, as I'm running, I've been writing a stanza with each mile. So some poems are 10 miles. I mean, I write 10 lines from 10 miles like I did today. And yesterday I wrote a poem for 15 lines because I ran 15 miles. Actually, I mentioned you in today's poem because I mentioned trying to remember your name. I didn't mention you the name, but I mentioned that I was trying to remember a name. And so I think that was the fourth mile when I mentioned it. Because I actually got your call in the fourth mile. So, I mean, like, everything, you know, you can make anything work as long as you're happy doing it. You know, and I think... I used to make fun of half marathons, but I understand them now that they're actually fun, you know? They're actually really
fun. Half marathons, yeah, I think they're challenging. I have no idea how to appropriately run like a 5K or a 10K, but I can have some sort of strategy behind the half marathon. That I can do. Marathon can handle the strategy behind that. 5K and 10K,
yeah.
I just go out and I burn out within the first 2 miles.
I actually have a strategy for that, and I don't know where I got it, but I rest a lot, and I just try to get my best time, and I'm always trying to get – and the funny thing is that really kills me. I've gotten my best time running just to run. You know, I've gotten like – I've done 5 miles in like, you know, 38 minutes. And then when I do the 5K – it takes me 23 to 24 minutes, and I know I could probably get it down to 19, but I somehow never get there. Which frustrates
me. It happens when you least expect it. That's how I got my half marathon and my 5K PR are both because I wasn't paying attention to the watch. I was just running, and I felt really good. And I found out at the end that I got PRs.
Oh, that's great. I'd love to have you on the show again after maybe your next big race, and then we could talk about that. I've actually asked other runners to come back on because I think with the show, I just want to keep bringing people new on and then bring them back on after they run some more races.
Yeah, I would love that, and I'll definitely take notes throughout my training of things to share.
No, I mean, every conversation is going to be different because each run is going to be different, so you're going to have a different experience with it. I've actually had my friend Benny on twice. And I had him on because we were both ran the Orange County Marathon, so we both talked about why we liked it. We actually both liked it, so we talked about how we liked the course. So, you know, I mean, I think I love the way you talk about running and your attitude towards it. Actually, I really enjoy talking to runners.
Yeah. I would love to come back and share after my race.
Well, let's think about September and, I'll send you new shows if you want to listen to them. Because as soon as it's done, I'm going to send you the link for the show and then you can, send it around and I'm going to send it to all the marathon sites that are on Facebook and other people I know will send it out for me too.
Oh, it's perfect.
But thanks a lot for being on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you. And we've been talking
to
Lynette.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I really don't want to mess up your last name. How do you say it again? Pedinici. See, Lynette Pedinici. And that is very Italian.
Yes. It is.
It is. I actually managed to say it like 20 or 40 times when I was running and I got it right. And it's just like, and then it just, the day came by and I got caught up in everything and I forgot what the hell I memorized. But it was great having you on. And I look forward to having you after September, after your next race.
Yes, thank you again for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, no, thank you for coming on. It it was great. And hope you go do well in your training and your next run, too. And thank you for coming on the show.
Awesome. Thank you.